So we should have a very enjoyable series on our hands.
Well, let's see if baseball does what it normally does and makes a big fat liar out of all of us.
And somebody said to me, goes, our business processes are still based on the same things that we started in 1977.
With the uprising of a young Yankees team, are the Jays in tough for competing in the near future?
Yes. Yes, they are. And welcome to episode number 79 of Artificial Turf Wars, where we are still trying to fold up that humongous American flag. Not as easy as it looks. I am your host, Greg Wisniewski, and I'm joined tonight by Joshua Howsam. Josh, how are you?
I'm good. And you?
I'm good. As you mentioned just before we launched here, I am ready to watch some good baseball, as I have been over the last week or so.
Crazy that, huh?
Yeah, it's almost like teams can play competently on a regular basis. We'll get into that because we're going to talk about our World Series picks. We're going to talk about the Arizona Fall League performances that some of the Blue Jays have turned in so far. I have a little chat maybe about our hypothetical 2018 Blue Jays outfields because we need some actual Blue Jays content. We are going to talk to Shai Davidi of Sportsnet, go into depth about what the future might hold for the Blue Jays going into 2018. And then we got your questions. We have a very odd do-over with Jeff Blair, who might need to read his history again. And that should be about it, I think. It'll take us where we need to go. So, World Series picks. I'm going to get right off the bat. What do you got, Josh? Who do you have as we launch Game 1 as we're recording this?
This is a tough one. I think this one's going to go to the limit, but I'm taking Houston.
Houston in 7. And
that's my pick.
I very much think the Dodgers have this, but I also think it's definitely not, doesn't look like a sweep of any kind to me. Like, these teams really, when they have a good night, they look impossible to beat. So I'm going to say Dodgers in 6 because they have the home field advantage thing. And I don't know. I just, I'm being a Dodgers fanboy this year, as we well know from previous podcasts. So I'm going to roll with that. But I don't think it's going to be easy.
Yeah. No, I'm with you there. I think whatever it is, it's going to be a really fun series to watch. Even if it's, you know, 5, 6, 7 games, I think every one of them is going to be tight.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, the other weird part is, of course, they're both going to be played in southern climates. And right now it's 102 degrees in LA at game time.
Yeah, it's a little bit warm.
I think that,
and just for the record, for those of you who don't know what the Fahrenheit conversion is, that's about 39 degrees Celsius in the end of October. That's very hot.
In the evening, no less. These are not afternoon games.
That's the game time temperature at 8 p.m. Well, Eastern, so it's 5 p.m. there.
But still, like, we're out of the so I remember a lot of World Series where the question was, how are they going to hit with cold hands and how are they going to grip the ball and, you know, are they allowed to go to their mouth? I remember that playing in Philadelphia outdoors in 93, it was very nearly a disaster.
my favorite was the one 1997 when it was Cleveland against Miami, or the Florida Marlins at that point. They go to the first couple games are in Florida and it's 85 degrees, which is like 30 here. Then they go to Cleveland and it was 30, which is sub-zero Celsius.
It's going to be odd seeing all of that. Not a huge difference, but that does in theory increase a little bit of the potential for the hitters to have an advantage.
Yeah, I can't remember. I think it might have been Darren Millman who tweeted this, or Mike Petriello. But the ball does fly farther when it's hotter, or rather, hitter slugging percentages go up. So we could see some offense from two teams that can hit the ball very well, although against two pitching staffs that are both very good.
And we do have a World Series finally with Yasiel Puig. Whether you are a Dodgers or an Astros fan, I think you appreciate his presence on the biggest stage in baseball.
Puig, your friend.
Puig might be my friend. I just haven't asked him yet. I can't see him saying no, right?
No, he seems like a nice guy. So here's something for you. Objectively, these are probably the two best teams in baseball, right?
Yes.
when was the last time that that happened? That the World Series was between the two best teams? I don't think it was any of the last 3 years.
Oh, no. No, I mean, I don't think you can even look at the wild card era, period, and say that it was the two best teams in baseball. I don't know. Oakland, San Francisco? Way back
either
in the
way,
90s.
It's a while, right? Yeah. I guess you could make a case for 2013 as the most recent potential one, when it was Boston and St. Louis, but not where it was objectively these two teams were the best.
Yeah, I mean, both with over 100 wins. You know, Cleveland had a very long winning streak, and that certainly, you know, made them look good. But again, they had to come back to earth at some point, just like the Dodgers did, right? The Dodgers looked like the 115-win team at one point, and then suddenly they weren't. The last time that two 100-win teams faced one another in the World Series was 1970.
That's a long time.
That's a long stretch between. Like, I wasn't alive in 1970, and I'm the old guy around Twitter where I'm chiming in on most of this stuff. So, yeah, does anybody remember, really, other than the people maybe in, you know, like Peter Gammons and that? Does anybody remember a 100-win team World Series?
I guess not. We certainly don't.
So you expect them to not beat themselves, I think is what we're coming right down to, which...
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, you get a team like, you know, I think of Texas when it went back-to-back years to the World Series, and it clearly had flaws, right? That's, you could see, oh, whether weak, you know, Nelson Cruz is a weak defender, which we found out the hard way, or, you know, you had a team trying to play Vlad Guerrero in the field, the Angels back in, can't remember the year now, 2012? Team's really trying to make do. And I can't think of anything going on with the Dodgers or the Astros where they're playing someone ridiculously out of position just to try and, you know, keep up.
No. And so we should have a very enjoyable series on our hands.
Well, let's see if baseball does what it normally does and makes a big fat liar out of all of us.
Yeah, someone's going to sweep, blow the other guys out every game.
Oh, okay. So from the peak performances of the people who've been in the league trying to do this their whole lives to the peak performances of the young Blue Jays in the Arizona mm-hmm. Fall League. So we talked to TJ Zoik, and as I noted on Twitter, and I think that the pod retweeted it, that he had a very nice first outing, did not allow a hit, I believe, three innings or something, struck out a few, looked very clean. I mean, obviously you can't scout him off of that, but it was nice for him to get off on the right foot. What else has happened out there?
Well, just continuing with friend of the podcast, TJ Zoik, he went out and threw another, it was four innings the first time, and then four the second time. He still doesn't give up a run or a walk.
So, yeah, throw strikes.
Eight innings.
Get out.
Throw strikes. Eight innings, eight strikeouts, no walks. That's pretty good.
Yeah. And again, this is better level of competition than he would have faced during the season, because these are all the teams, you know, hot hands, so to speak, or guys who need extra work, but mostly guys who they think are going somewhere.
And also guys that mostly have played in AA, right? Which he has not.
Mm-hmm. So that's cool.
Yeah. And the guys that are more interesting, other than TJ Zoik, the pitchers are sort of just organizational guys for the most part. Jackson McClelland, Andrew Case, although Case is doing quite well. But it's the hitters who people really wanted to see, because Lourdes Gurriel is there, Max Pentecost is there, and these are guys that are people are really looking out for. Gurriel's doing, he's having an interesting start to it. He's hitting 257 with a 257 on base, but a 543 slugging.
Yeah. He's there apparently to swing.
Yeah, he has no walks, obviously, in 35 plate appearances, but he's also got four doubles and two bombs.
Yeah, I believe he started off like 1-for-7, or I don't know. I was looking at the line after his first couple games. I was like, dude, he was on the interstate, as they say, at like something like 173 he was hitting or whatever. But then he hit home runs, you know, in a couple games in a row, and all of a sudden the stat line looks way better, though. Maybe no walks is not what you want to see, even from a contact guy.
Yeah, I mean, there are no walks, but three strikeouts. So he's definitely putting the bat on the ball. And given he had some injury issues, I wonder if he's just trying to make up for time by swinging.
Mm. Like when they put somebody at the top of the lineup when he's on an injury rehab.
Right, exactly. The same kind of idea. So who knows? I mean, it'd be interesting to see what he does next year, because he's obviously not going to be in the big leagues, but he's showing some pop and some ability to drive the ball, which is pretty useful for a guy who can play a bunch of positions.
So you mentioned Max Pentecost, who I might add, for the people not familiar with him, is most famous for being injured all the time.
Yeah. And finally wasn't injured this year and actually had a pretty decent season. He even played catcher. I mean, whoa.
You mean the catcher of the future is catching?
I know. Well, last year he didn't. Last year he was a DH. The catcher of the future was a designated hitter.
That's so wrong. It's
about as far away on the defensive scale as you can get from catcher.
But no more.
No. But he's hitting like a catcher in the Arizona Fall League.
Hmm.
2-for-18 with 10 strikeouts. He is not playing very well.
That's the Jared Saltalamacchia method.
Hey, he's got two hits.
Oh, sorry. Sorry, it's the Luke Melee method.
There you go.
There we are.
And I just want to quickly touch on the prospect, right? Vladimir Guerrero Jr. is playing in winter ball with adults, right? Yeah, there are some kids, but he's out there as among the big leaguers as well. And he's holding his own. He's got a 269 average with a 367 on base. The power's not there, but he's only struck out once.
Now, that happened when he moved to high A as well. Interestingly, it took him a long time to start hitting for power again. So I don't know if this is how he adjusts to changes. His first, he tries to focus in on making contact again. And then he's, maybe he settles in, maybe he doesn't. He is still, like you said, a kid among men.
Yeah, he's now actually still 18 and will be for another 5 months.
Now, not to take us too far off track, but did I not see footage of Roberto Osuna batting left-handed, hitting a home run?
You did see that. He hit a bomb.
Why did I see that? What is Roberto Osuna doing?
Hitting bombs.
But contextually, it doesn't seem like a skill he'd need to work on, seeing as he's an American League relief pitcher.
Oh, who knows? But he was having some fun, that's for sure.
Left-handed.
Yeah. Hey, the Jays have been trying to find some left-handed bats.
Let's not complicate Mr. Osuna's career path any more than it's already going to be, given how many times he's been used and abused. Oh, dear. Okay, so who else do we have in the AFL? Anyone else we forgot?
Not that I think is really overly noteworthy.
All right. So, two good news is one... less than good news, other than he's still healthy, Max Pentecost.
Yeah.
All right, so I at least briefly, maybe it'll end up being more than briefly, wanted to touch on, and we're going to talk with Shai Davidi in a bit about, different things that have been going on for the future of the Blue Jays, but I wanted to go into a little more detail about just the Jays' outfield this week. Hypothetically, what does the outfield look like in 2018? Trying to figure this out. Because there is no everyday left fielder or everyday right fielder at the moment. And we got Kevin Pillar, for now, slotted into center. Is that fair?
Yeah, I think it is.
So the people in the organization that we might see playing those positions that we know of, Teoscar Hernandez, Ezekiel Carrera, is it fair to say?
I think so. I think there's a shot for that.
Dwight Smith Jr., Anthony Alford, and Dalton Pompey.
And Steve Pierce.
Yeah. Because they have to play Steve Pierce somewhere. Because he can hit. what is your... out of that configuration... And again, you can include perhaps getting rid of one of those guys in order to try and do something else with him, if you were going to get rid of somebody or multiple guys. What is your configuration for the outfield that you think the Jays would be most competitive with?
I think, well, if we have to stick with those guys, I think it's probably Hernandez and in one corner and Alford in the other, assuming Pilar's in the center. But I don't think it's going to be that. I think they're going to get someone from outside the organization for one of those two spots, and I think they're going to start the other one with Hernandez in left field or right field, depending on what corner they get.
So a lot of people talked about Teoscar Hernandez making a, they were showcasing him to see what they had, but also maybe so other teams could see what he had. But I'm wondering if they were really showcasing him to make sure that they had enough, you know, whatever analysis they're doing to play him every day, so that the real guy on the trading block is maybe Kevin Pillar.
I don't know about that. Those two things being connected, simply because Teoscar Hernandez isn't really a center fielder. So I think it's more seeing what they've got in him, because they think that Alfred can handle center field. I think you have to connect those two if Pillar is the guy that they could be trading.
Right. So you try and play Alfred in center, Hernandez in right or left, depending on how strong of a outfielder you get. And then you fill in the gaps with either Steve Pierce or Ezequiel Carrera as your backup.
Yeah. And, you know, it's interesting you mentioned this with all those names that you threw out there, right? I don't think Dalton Pompey is going to be make the opening day roster because he was injured all year, which means they actually have another option year on him.
But yay.
So the thing with Pompey, right? He's been pretty good when he's been healthy. He just hasn't been healthy. This year he got killed by Ernie Witt in the World Baseball Classic. You know, gets a concussion and Ernie Witt sends him back out there to play center field for three innings.
Yeah. Well, we've learned what to expect with Ernie Witt. But yeah, I mean, Dalton Pompey has gotten a raw deal, and you know, they didn't mention him by name, but I'm wondering if he was part of Ross Atkins' communication problem.
Oh, yeah, no kidding. But I think that there's still a chance he could be something. I just don't think it's going to be next year with the Blue Jays. But there's still a bunch of guys you threw names out, and they also have, I think it's five catchers that need to be added to the 40-man roster, including the aforementioned Max Pentecost. That means that there's going to be guys that probably end up traded just because there's too many guys to take up all these spots. And I think we're going to actually see this organization trade some prospect depth for a major leaguer, which we haven't seen them do yet.
And I think that's a reasonable guess to take because, again, we'll probably talk about this later, but if they're going to compete in 2018, they don't need all of the minor league talent they have arrayed the way it is. They need minor league talent, but they need major league talent worse if they're going to make a run at it in 2018. So there's a couple of different hypothetical outfields, and we both predict that someone is leaving the organization because there just isn't room for everybody in the organization. Fair enough?
Yeah.
He said. I will leave it at that, and at that we will go and have a chat with Shai Davidi about all of the other things that might change come opening day 2018 and try and clear up what's been going on in the offseason so far. We'll be right back. And we are pleased this week to be joined by Shai Davidi of Sportsnet. Shai, welcome back to Artificial Turf Wars.
Thanks for having me.
Good to have you on. We are done the whole 2017 season, and we've probably had enough of that. So they're starting to make some changes slowly, and we haven't seen any really like personnel player changes, but notable, the coaching staff was brought back, apparently as a whole. But the training staff got shuffled around. So I just wanted some thoughts from you on who they were, you know, why they would keep the coaching staff on a team that wasn't all that successful, and then whether what comments led to that sort of dismissal of people in the training department.
Sure. Well, we'll start with the coaching staff. And this group say for DeMarlo Hale, who opted to go year to year instead of take a multi-year commitment. They were all extended in the early part of the season to match John Gibbons' tenure through the two with a guarantee through the 2018 season with an option on 2019. So, they would just, extended an article of faith in them made a commitment to them, say, we believe in you, and then to suddenly turn around and fire them after a season in which they lost over 1,400 man games to injury, had 25 players take 31 stints on the disabled list. It's pretty hard to pin that on a coaching staff, you know, when they were trying to win at times with Cesar Valdez and Casey Lawrence in the starting rotation. So I think from that aspect, you look at the job the coaching staff is doing, and you know, if do they bear responsibility? Is it something that happened in the course of play that you're like, coaching is the issue? And you know, from my eyes, and perhaps I'm biased, but you know, I think that coaching staff is a very hardworking coaching staff that connects with the players, that is suitable for that group. But I do think that if things don't go right next year, I would expect to see changes relatively early in the season to that group, because the timing works for that. Because if the group if things fall apart next year, then you'll start resetting the core, moving some veterans, getting a younger group, and at that time you'd want to adjust the coaching staff to the next wave of players. As for the training staff, I haven't heard anyone say a bad thing about Chris Joyner, the strength and conditioning coach, and Mike Frostad, the assistant trainer, who have been longtime members of the organization, been around for a long period of time. So I don't know, but we did hear Ross Atkins say at the end of the season that there were communication issues. I think that with the addition of so many people for the high performance department, there are extra layers now, and they had some troubles, at least that's the indication that from things people are saying, that they had some troubles with all the different layers interacting and communicating the right things to players or being clear in direction and things of that nature. So they made some changes, and I don't know whether, you know, it's that Frostad and Joyner deserve the blame. I have never heard anybody say a bad thing about them, but clearly the organization felt that those were the moves that they needed to make in order to make the process work better.
It's interesting you talked about the layers and communication issues. Do you think that may have been part of the reason for the culling in the communications department, where it's now basically just Jay Stenhouse?
No, I don't think that one has to do with the other. I mean, the internal communications it wouldn't involve the communications department. The communication department focuses on outward projection to media and other public stakeholders, as opposed to the internal layers of the organization communicating with one another.
I realized that I asked that question poorly. I meant, do you think it was sort of like they felt that redundancies that they had noticed in other departments made them get rid of redundancies in other departments like the communications department? I wasn't trying to blame the communications department for the training.
Oh, sure. So I don't think I don't think there was a redundancy there. And I think that the Blue Jays communications department is a bit smaller than some teams around the league, and Toronto has one of the larger media contingencies covering the team in baseball. I still don't really understand why that group was let go. Sue Malibon is a terrific person who had been with the organization for decades and made sure that everything functioned. She made a difference for a lot of people. She made sure things functioned well. Mal Romanen and Eric Grossman were just total pros who knew what to do and who did their jobs exceptionally well. So, I mean, I don't understand it. You know, I've heard the different things that they've said. We'll see. Right now it's a small department under Sebastian Gatica and Jay Stenhouse. And, I assume they're going to add to it at some point, and we'll see how it functions differently moving forward. But, from my vantage point, I think they got worse in that regard.
So the team is talking the talk, at least, about, an improved experience for the fans, an improved experience at the ballpark. They've been talking about a renovation now pretty much since the new general manager arrived. They seem to be big on talk, but they haven't really come out and said what all that means. So as they're, getting rid of these people and shuffling people around, is there any sense of what they're actually going to add or going to change in terms of how things work in Blue Jays land for the fan?
That's a good question. I think they've started moving a little bit more, trying to do a few more things through social media. Last season, You know, I think it's really too early to say for certain how they intend to communicate for with fans and what they intend to do. You know, I mean, they made some changes to their to the people who handle their social media with April Witzman and Ali Conrapiani, who's doing a lot of stuff for them. So, I mean, you know, the changes have been very sweeping, we'll put it that way. And I think it's going to take some time to assess what they do. I mean, they've got a clean slate now, if that's what they were looking for. And we'll get a read at some point when they start filling some of those positions on what they want to do differently. But right now, I don't know. And I think it's going to take some time for all this to shake out because it's still all relatively fresh.
Yeah, it seems like they're definitely, you know, heading somewhere, but the direction doesn't seem to be coming through other than, well, we don't want what used to be. And I was just, you know, I'm kind of waiting with bated breath here to see what's next. Presumably they're going to try and convince us that it's better.
The one thing I will say is that when there are changes to an organization, there are generally a lot of changes. And, you know, for better or for worse, the Blue Jays have done a lot of things the way that they had done it essentially since inception in 1977. When I wrote my book, Blue Jays Big 50, after the 2015 season, I wrote a bit about the executives and how they started up. And somebody said to me, he goes, our business processes are still based on the same things that we started in 1977. And the world has changed substantially since then. And I think that this organization did have a lot of areas in which it needed to catch up on. Now, they're using, you know, fans may not like this, but dynamic ticket pricing is something that sports teams everywhere were using, and the Blue Jays just introduced, you know, the different tiers of ticket pricing, using analytics to get a better sense of how to monetize various things is something that a lot of modern businesses have been doing. And that the Blue Jays weren't for a long time. And I think the modernization of the business practices of the team have been important and are going to be important long-term for the team, because if the more they can monetize the product, theoretically, the more money they should be putting into player payroll and things of that nature. And certainly the Blue Jays need to be judged based on whether or not they do that. So I think to a degree that's fair. But, you know, you don't want to throw out the baby with the bathwater. And I think some very good people who could have made a difference and who were good people who deserved a lot better, you know, ended up losing their jobs. And, you know, I feel terribly for them.
Well, taking it away from the sadness of all the people that have recently found themselves in the employment line, you mentioned the payroll and, you know, as it relates to the budget increases or rather the cost increases for fans and what and everybody. Do you have a sense of what they might be doing with regards to payroll in the next season?
Well, I mean, the indications that I had were that the Blue Jays were going to be in the same sort of payroll range that they were in this year. So, like, I don't know, like between 160, 165 million, depending on how, you know, you count all the different things. So, I mean, that's sort of the general range that I expect them to be in. But, you know, they have been in the last little while. It could be just coming up, or it could be just completed, working on their planning for the offseason and getting final approvals on their different approaches, depending on how things play out over the winter. So, you know, maybe there's a touch more. I wouldn't think so. I wouldn't think that it's going to go down. Theoretically, that's possible. But, you know, the indications that I'd gotten were that they'd probably be around the same level that they were this year.
So, assuming that's true, which makes a lot of sense, really, Atkins obviously was talking about this at the end of the season, and he sort of dropped a bit of a bomb, potentially, where he said that they want to add an impact arm and an impact bat. Now, obviously, that term is up for some interpretation. What is your sense of what that actually meant?
It's kind of funny, because after he said that, my colleague Ben Nicholson Smith and I, we both followed up with Ross, and we said, look, you know, when you're talking an impact, what are you talking about? Because some people would look at, you know, is what's your perception? Some people hear impact will say, oh, that's like a three-win player, right? But you can make an argument that someone, you know, at 1.5 could be an impact player depending on where you're playing them. So we said, like, what are we talking about here? And he kind of seeded the point that it can be interpreted differently. But I think the sense was we're talking of trying about like a 1.5 to 2 win type of player. Now, if it's more, great. But that caliber of player who can make that kind of impact is sort of what he was talking about. Now, it's going to be interesting to see how they're going to pull that off because, I mean, the Blue Jays are going to be spending a lot of money in arbitration this year. You know, Josh Donaldson's going to get a sizable raise. Marcus Stroman is going to get a sizable raise. Roberto Osuna, perhaps almost more than the others, is going to get a very sizable raise. He's going to go from league minimum to probably around $6 million. So that a lot of the money that's being freed up with the departure of Jose Bautista, I mean, that's going right into arb raises. So the Blue Jays have a little bit of money to work with. They spent some of it re-signing Marco Estrada. But, you know, they're going to have to be pretty creative to get both an impact arm and an impact bat.
No, and, you know, you just mentioned how tough it might be to even get that 1 or 2 win player. But even if they somehow manage it, they've got a bunch of 40-man decisions. They could potentially make some trades. But if that's what they pull in, isn't it something of a bit of a PR misstep to say impact player and then pull in essentially a league average player?
Well, I think this is where, you know, your perceptions of what baseball is. I mean, like the Blue Jays ran out a lot of players who were, you know, below league average or average players, right? Or replacement level kind of caliber of players, right? So if you're replacing a guy who gave you like, you know, between zero and to half a win with a guy who's 1.5, 2, well, you've done something substantial for your team. So I think that you know, how you make the upgrade is going to be interesting. I think ultimately it's like if you're getting the upgrade and it's a sizable improvement over what you were running out there, even if it's not what you say like an all-star guy, you know, you're still better. And then you factor in, you know, a full season of Josh Donaldson, ideally a lot more of Troy Tulowitzki, a Devin Travis who's a bit more healthy, you know, full year of Jay Happ, you know, a Marco Estrada who doesn't disappear for 2 months, you know, Aaron Sanchez alone. I mean, he could add 5 wins to your rotation if he's healthy for the year. So I think that there's enough there that you can say, all right, there's enough upside that, you know, if things go sort of right, you know, and then we just make these incremental gains around the diamond, it's going to be a good team. And the thing to remember is that, you know, the league isn't miles ahead of the Blue Jays. I mean, like the Astros and the Indians, they're miles ahead of the Blue Jays. But the rest of the league, you know, I think they're catchable. I mean, the Blue Jays could very easily be a wild card team next year. And then once you get in, you never know.
You really worked that positivity. I got to say, you... this is a team that did not break the 500 mark all season. Not that they couldn't have, but they never did in a division that was weak as anything. So I think it's, you know, it's not disingenuous of the Blue Jays to try and do this, but to spin it as a championship caliber team, I think is probably a little bit generous. Don't you? You wonder about that?
Like this... But that's what I said. I mean, this is a team that could win a wild card, right? I mean, I don't think they're the class in the American League East. They've got the Red Sox and the Yankees are a fair bit ahead of them right now. But I think that, you know, that if you look at all the things that went wrong this year, I mean, like, I was thinking back that we did at Sportsnet.ca, we did a little roundtable before the season, with Blair, Arden, Ben, Wilner, myself. And we each listed something different. One of the things was, what's one thing that the Blue Jays can't have go wrong this year? And each one of us listed something different. They all happened, plus like 3 more things. You know what I mean? Like, everything this season was the worst case scenario. I mean, like everything that was terrible
that could happen to this team happen to this team, right? And so, you know, I don't, you know, I think you can't kind of like focus too much on what happened this year and say like everything's going to happen that bad again next year. Do they need everything to fall their way next year? Absolutely. I mean, like, it's not like they're going to go in like, absolutely, this is 100% a wild card team, but you could have a pretty good starting rotation with, if Aaron Sanchez is healthy, with Marcus Stroman and Jay Happ and Marco Estrada, and then you figure out what, you know, is Joe Biagini your guy? Are you doing something else? You know, you've got a rotation that is going to give you a chance to compete. You've got a top five player in the game, arguably, with Josh Donaldson. And then you've got, if Justin Smoke can repeat, I mean, you've got an all-star slugger to pair him with. Kendrys Morales, if he's around, maybe he can be a little bit better than he was this past season, and he's not giving you, say, you know, a hollow or as hollow with 25 homers and 90 RBIs or whatever it ends up being. So like, you can look at it and you can say, all right, well, they've got a chance. You know, are the Twins that much better than them? I don't think so. I mean, the Twins are a nice team. They've got lots of young players and they have athleticism. They do some things, but I don't think that it's inconceivable the Blue Jays catch them. Now, does that mean they're going to win the World Series? No, they're not better than the Astros right now. They're not better than Cleveland or Boston or the Yankees. But it's in a short series, strange things happen, right? You know, I mean, the Cardinals won, the 83, 84 games 1 year and went to the World Series. So
83.
You know, you just have to be 83. And so, you know, if everything goes right, they could conceivably be that team. And I think if you're the Blue Jays, you know, like, you want to try rather than embark on the rebuild right away, because that's not going to be fun for anybody. So you give it a shot. You try not to tie yourself down with too many things that'll get in the way of a rebuild. And if it works, great. You have a nice season, and then you start finding ways to integrate young players. And if it doesn't, you know, you start reallocating your assets and begin the countdown for Vladimir Guerrero and Bo Bichette.
All right. So, sorry. Just leading into that, you sort of was my final question. Was just for fun having. And you alluded to it, but having seen everything that's gone down in these playoffs and the level of baseball that's being played in the playoffs right now, if the Blue Jays had snuck in, say, instead of Minnesota, into that final wild card berth, how far do you think that the team we did see in 2017 would have got into the playoffs?
I mean, it's an interesting question. Are the guys playing the way they did in 2017, or are they closer to their career norms? You know what I mean? Like, is Troy Tulowitzki the guy he was in 2016? If you get that version of Troy Tulowitzki, and you get, you know, 2016 Josh Donaldson, and you have Justin Smoke who's peaking, well, I mean, that's interesting enough. I mean, that could give you a shot to do some damage. I mean, it's clear that one of the things they have to figure out is that they can't clog the bases the way they did this year, right? I mean, they can't require three hits to score a guy if they're not getting a home run. You know, that's something that they have to resolve. They have to be able to you know, score more often from first base on a ball in the gap and things of that nature. And I think that's important for them. But, you know, I mean, it's hard to imagine if, you know, I envision this group potentially being something closer to what it was in 2016 than it was in 2017. And so if it's that 2016 group, I mean, look, that was a team that disappeared in September, looked like it was dead, recovered on the final weekend of the season, won a wild card, swept the heavily favored Texas Rangers, and then ran into a buzzsaw against Cleveland in ALCS. So, you know, it could be that kind of year too. And I'm not sure I completely answered that question, but, you know, it's hard to kind of say, oh, well, this group makes the playoffs. Well, if they performed the way they did this year, they would have gotten killed, right?
Fair enough.
Yeah, I my take was, well, if they got in with, say, Minnesota's record or Boston's record, my inclination is to think that they probably would have got about as far as Minnesota and Boston got. That there's so much, this year anyway, there's just so much talent from the Astros and from Cleveland and, you know, eventually from the Dodgers and even the Nationals, that it would be hard for me to see the Jays getting to the World Series on a wild card berth. But maybe that's just, you know, hindsight on my part. That said, like, yeah,
I don't think it's likely, but I mean, I think, like, if you're a fan, don't you want them taking a final shot within the competitive window and seeing what happens, rather than, you know, saying, all right, well, let's punt until 2020 or 2021 and let's see what happens. You know, take your shot in 17 or in 18. Maybe it happens. And you get a wild card, hey, you know, that's a good season, and that's fun, and, you know, who knows what happens. It's better than the alternative of just saying, all right, we're just going to go young, and we're gonna clear things out, and we're going to try not to lose 100 games until Vladdy and Bo get here.
All right, on that note, I think that covers sort of our view going into the offseason. We might talk to you one more time or so before spring training, depending on how things shake out. But thanks for stopping by.
Yeah, my pleasure. No problem, guys.
Ladies and gentlemen, Shai Davidi of Sportsnet. You can find him on the Twitter. And we will talk to you soon. And there you have it. You know, what you really have is a discussion of whether it's worth it to go for it in 2018. And for once, you and I appear to disagree.
Yeah. Although, just before we go, I'm sorry for mangling some of those questions.
Interviewing's
You're better at
hard.
This than me.
yeah. Well, we're just making it up as we go along anyway. Yeah. So I don't like doing things by half measure, and I feel, the way it's looking right now, I feel like 2018 is destined to be a season of half measures, but it's clear you don't think that way.
No, I don't. The reason I don't have a problem with this idea of the half measure, as you put it, is because it doesn't really force you to decide for sure that that's the way you're going to do things. You know, you can go through the first couple months of the season and see where this team really is, because as we talked about with Shai, everything that could have gone wrong did. And you go into next season and it's like, okay, well, this is going right or this isn't. And you see where you are after a couple months. And if it looks just as bad as this year, you've got assets to trade and still restock and re-go for it again in the following year or 2 years later.
So you're talking about, see, and in the old format, to me, where the playoffs did not involve a third of the league, it was easier to make that decision earlier. But the last few years, especially with the rather weird way the AL East keeps working out, is everybody seems to be probably in it for quite a while. And my question is, if this team needs, let's say the team is in a position to take a wild card berth, you know, how much does this team have to pour in asset wise, or how much does it trade away to try and make that wild card berth when that decision comes? And it's a good decision to make. And I think you could very easily get into a situation where, like this year, it looked like maybe with a good run, they could make the playoffs. And they decided this year to just stand pat, more or less, sell a couple pieces, but not do anything else. I'm not really comfortable with them going in there again.
Well, I think that part of that, the reason they did it this year, the way they did it, is because they didn't really have another choice. I mean, all of the guys that they could have traded sucked. Like, what were you going to get for Jose Bautista or Marco Estrada? You weren't going to get anything the way they were playing around the deadline, right?
And there's the other danger of going into this year and going, well, we'll see what we have. And it turns out that the guys who you know, your flexible guys again, are who? Who are your assets you're going to trade away next year if it's not going well?
Well, I think that there's the differences between last year and this year is that the guys that you think you might be trading are guys that have a better track record. Estrada happened just to be on the worst stretch of his career. I mean, that happens. But Bautista was on the decline. Liriano is Liriano. And then it was relievers.
Well, yeah, but at the beginning of the season, you weren't looking at Bautista and thinking he was on the decline. That's the benefit of hindsight. At the beginning of the season...
But even going into the season, if you told me the Jays are going to get a haul for Jose Bautista at the deadline, I would have questioned that just because of the year he had prior. And the fact that nobody wanted to sign him, really.
That was more of a red flag than the year he had prior to me.
Right, but those two things combined make it seem like he's never going to be a big trade asset. But you go into this deadline with Jay Happ, Josh Donaldson, and probably Justin Smoke, right? The odds of all of those guys tanking, all three of them tanking, are pretty slim based on what we have seen out of them. And then on top of that, you have Estrada and whoever relievers you want to trade.
I would, if you're aiming for 2019, you're going to trade for, you know, a whole year's value, and you're going to get more control and more back, I think, if you're really aiming for 2019 and you're hoping for some of your minor league guys to pan out.
But if you're blowing it up, you're aiming for 2020. You're not going for 2019.
Well, then you and I will agree to disagree there.
Okay.
I think the Jays are in a tough spot, though. I don't think this is an easy decision either way. I don't think it's as obvious as I'm making it sound, or I want it to be, and I don't think it's as obvious as you're, you know, making it sound at the moment.
Yeah, no, I'm with you.
And that's why we don't have to be Major League Baseball general managers.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, surely they're going to have to... Well, they seem to have already committed to the idea of competing. But to me, it sounds like... And they won't say it, but it sounds very much more like competing for the wild card than it does competing for the division.
Yes, it does. I agree.
And that is a little bit problematic. It's not the end of the world, because you can always accidentally win the division if you seriously are competing for the wild card. But...
Yeah. I just think that if you don't go all the way in, don't go halfway in, right? Just go with what you've got plus some, you know, minor additions, right? Mm-hmm. Either go for it and go for it, or just see what you've got and see how it does in year two.
Yeah, and I think we'll see how much their incremental improvement incrementally actually improves them. And the really weird part is baseball right now, as my last point, is that you watch the Twins go from crap to wildcard team without making any major changes at all. How does that work?
There you go.
Oh, my goodness. How about we move on from this circular discussion and we talk about...
Time now to hear from our listeners.
That just seems silly.
Here are the rules. First, I ask a question, then you ask a question.
Now, how does that sound, sweetheart?
Could you repeat the question, please?
All right, we've got a few. We're going to try and get through them all. Question number one from Stu. Is that the first one, I think, from bottom up here? C-Dub, at C-Dub Centerfield. That's a new question asker, I believe. Mm-hmm. Who will have the best hair on the Jays next year, Donaldson, Travis, or Lourdes Gurriel Jr.? I presume Lourdes Gurriel Jr. got on that list because of his brother's hair.
Yes, that does seem to be the case. I don't actually know what Lourdes' hair looks like.
Neither do I. I bet you neither does anybody at the moment who isn't avidly watching the AFL. So who's your hair guy?
Can I say none of the above? I think it's all terrible.
You don't like Travis's fade?
No. The fade with the blonde on top? No.
Yeah, it does raise some questions, doesn't it? Donaldson always looks kind of greasy to me, but some people seem to be into that.
Yeah, so I'm going to go with Lourdes just because I haven't seen him be bad yet.
the hair I have not seen. Oh, my goodness. Who's next?
This is from Josh at Maple Blue Raps. Okay. Toronto sports fan. With the uprising of a young Yankees team, are the Jays in tough for competing in the near future?
Yes. Yes, they are. So I don't know if 52 home runs are normal for Aaron Judge. The problem is, even if 40 home runs are normal for Aaron Judge and regular catcher Gary Sanchez is good for 30 plus the kind of other power numbers these guys have been putting up. I don't know if you remember the last time that the Yankees had two homegrown players, you know, under 26 years old. But as I recall, one of them was named Derek Jeter, and it didn't look good. The Blue Jays, the Yankees' weakness is pitching in the long run, but they have so much money. And now they have two very good, very controllable players, and I'm not even talking about Greg Bird.
Yeah, well, Greg Bird has to show he can stay healthy before he can even get in that conversation. But I do think that the same issue that Jays are facing in Boston with Mookie Betts, Xander Bogaerts, Andrew Benintendi, there's a lot of really good young talent on the top two spending teams in division, which makes it very hard. But I do think it's worth looking at that Boston team where Betts, Bogaerts, they both took big steps back this year, which does happen with these young guys. Sometimes it's just their first season is the lightning in a bottle season. So they might not actually be this good. Now, I'm not saying I expect that, but there's a chance.
Nevertheless, that Betts Bogaerts group still managed to win the division this year.
Yeah, but based on their pitching, their offense wasn't very good.
True. Again, we're back to the rich team can figure out something.
Exactly.
Okay. Brian. Hey, Brian. At big_B_SR. How many bat flips will we see during the World Series? I say 23. I guess that depends how long the series is.
Well, as we're recording this, Chris Taylor has hit a home run and didn't bat flip it. So I'm going to say, based on this pace, it's zero.
I will give it bat flips people talk about six. Now, how many from Yasiel Puig that nobody bothers to mention anymore? Maybe we'll get to 23.
Because he flips it every time?
Yeah. He doesn't flip on home runs, though. Only doubles and walks. Oh, my goodness. You want to hit the next one?
Sure. This is from Colleen Evans. Why has it taken us so long to find out that Lourdes Gurriel Jr. has a nickname,
Yunito? Which is actually, I think she means brother, not a nickname.
No. It's his nickname.
Okay.
It's Yunito. This came out in an article about Yuli Gurriel. It came out that Lourdes' nickname is Yunito.
Okay. why is it taking so long to figure out he has a nickname? Because the Sportsnet or the Toronto media cluster hasn't gotten around to picking apart his life yet?
I mean, that's pretty much the answer. That's like no one really knew that Osuna was Little Cannon until Baseball Reference showed it. I mean, it's just these nicknames tend not to necessarily last when they get to the big leagues. This, you know, and this is what he had from playing Cuban baseball. But when he gets around a big league clubhouse, it might be something entirely different.
Indeed. Yeah, and for everyone wondering, in Cuba, Lourdes Gurriel Jr. was never as good as his brother, who you are watching play right now for the Astros. Just in case you're overly
excited. Public service announcement.
Another one from Colleen. Why did Otis Nixon attempt to bunt in the 1992 World Series in the bottom of the 11th with two out? I can only imagine the outrage had the Jays tried that move in any of their postseason games.
Because he was on the take? It was insane at the time. Nixon is a very good bunter. He bunted for hits all the time. But if you're going to bunt for a hit in that spot, why are you drag bunting on a pitcher who falls off to the first base side?
Not much made sense in the 11th inning.
It's true. Maybe he was just tired.
Why are you bunting with two out? I don't trust myself to get a hit. Only thing I remember being mentioned at the time, and it was ridiculous, was that somehow Joe Carter wouldn't know where to be because he wasn't used to being at first base.
Even though Joe Carter reminded Timlin that he could probably going to bunt before that. So he was clearly aware what the situation was going to be there.
And where to go.
Yeah.
Connor Moore, at Connor Moore LD, do you think there is any value to exploring Osuna as a starter in 2018?
This used to be at the Seahound, right?
I believe so, yes.
Yeah. I do. I think there is. I don't think they're going to do it. I think he's entrenched as the closer. But given the state of the rotation, which it has some depth, but doesn't actually have a fifth guy right now, the idea of having Roberto Osuna's upside in the rotation is something that sounds like a pretty good idea, right?
Yep. But we know that there is a certain amount of inertia built into baseball.
Yep.
And your friend Inertia is going to do one thing with Roto Osuna, and that's put him back in a closer's role until he breaks.
Yeah, he's stuck.
Yeah. Now, if he breaks, I could see them trying to bring him back as a starter, potentially.
Yeah.
But I hope he doesn't break. Yeah. Same said. All right. Now, you picked a real doozy. You found a do-over for me. So the first thing
we'll do... Wait, we had one last question.
Oh, we did? I didn't see that one.
Yeah, it must have come in after you checked it.
My bad.
From at Split Letters, Luke J. Bats Forever. What do I do to survive the next 156 days?
Look outside the window. Wait for spring.
I don't know. Like, enjoy life because you don't have to watch the Blue Jays.
Yeah, I don't know how many of the last 172 days I enjoyed, really, in the general perspective of things. Yeah. Get a hobby.
Yeah.
And every 2 weeks you can tune in for us, because we'll still be here. Right. You brought me a do-over, so I'm going to play the do-over thing.
Oh my god, did he really just say that?
But we can try again, right?
You talking about a do-over, baby? Are you talking about a f***ing door?
We believe in second chances.
Now, you brought me this because Jeff Blair is apparently not a student of history. So, from the Jeff Blair Show on Sportsnet 590, it is a long clip, but here it is.
And one of the points, I'm sorry, it was him or Cliff Floyd. One of the points they made was that, you know, when you don't have that chance to come back after you've won the World Series, it's almost as if the celebration is cut short a little bit when you don't come back with the same team, with the same group. You know, yeah, you've got the off season, you know, and you kind of live off the glow of the World Series win. But their point was it would have been so great to show up in spring training with the same group of guys and almost like just extend it a little longer. And then as you guys did, you did more than extend it. You went out and won again in 93. See, I would think that would be really special, that not only did you do it once, but you had a chance to celebrate. You had a chance to build on it and do it again.
Well, unfortunately for me, I wasn't there in 93.
Or 93, sorry, right, yeah.
All of that buildup was to Tom Henke.
So that was only the end of the clip. He was talking about that story for a minute and a half before actually asking the question.
I like how Tom,
to a guy who wasn't there,
very politely did not interrupt Mr. Blair. Like, he literally went on for 2.5 minutes getting his foot farther and farther in his mouth. The part that really confuses me is Dwayne Ward played a rather large role in the concluding game of Game 6 of the 1993 World Series. Do you remember?
Well, Dwayne Ward came in and shut the door in the ninth.
Dwayne Ward was the pitcher of record. He was the last pitcher in 1993.
Dwayne Ward had 4 wins in the 2 World Series.
Yeah. Talk about right place at the right time.
Yeah.
Yeah. So he was the closer. Sorry, just shaking my head. Which Jeff Blair conveniently forgot while he was interviewing Tom Henke.
Yeah, this is kind of like the idea of what the do-over was about. Like, clearly he just sort of, he had this question that he wanted to ask someone and just completely forgot that Henke just wasn't there at that point, which, you know, it was 24 years ago when 1993 season, but still pretty bad.
You got to check that stuff before you go in that. You just have to check.
Yeah.
Oh my goodness. So the do-over, Jeff Blair. We would like you to open up the baseball reference page of whatever baseball player you were talking to. Whenever
and
you
see what
them.
Teams they played for when.
Yep, that's it. It's not hard. Do you have a final thought for this first truly post Blue Jays season edition of our little show?
Yeah, I'm enjoying watching good baseball again without really truly caring who wins. I mean, I didn't want the Yankees or Boston to win, but they didn't. So,
yay.
Yeah. So I'm just enjoying this. I'm like, it's nice. After 2 years of, we talked about this before, but after 2 years of really tough, tense playoff games, it's nice to just enjoy it.
Yeah. I mean, I have my preferences, but I will not be crying if the Dodgers don't win you know, right. I won't. It's cool, and you can watch the performance for the performance, you know, objectively, and I think that's pretty cool too.
And it's a good thing I wasn't crying, because the two teams I wanted were the Rockies, who lost the wild card game, and then the Nationals, who just can't win.
Yes. My final thought is, if you are on Twitter and you are not already following old Haas Radborn for the playoffs, you should probably get on that. Very amusing. If you don't know who old Haas Radborn was, he's a real historical person who once won 60 games for one team in 1 year, basically by taking the ball every bloody day. And for some reason, he's dead, but he's on Twitter. So,
it's just his ghost.
Yeah,
it's haunted the internet.
But his take is a little different than a lot of your typical commentators, considering he still thinks things should be the way they were back in the 1890s when he pitched.
It's 1880s. It's, you're overselling him.
Sorry, it's weird, but it's definitely worth checking out. Oh, that said, you were Joshua Hausam at Joshua Hausam, and I was Greg Wisniewski at Coolhead 2010, and our guest was Shai Davidi of Sportsnet. Is it at Shai Davidi?
Yes, and just before we go, we'd like to thank our newest patron, Matt Sweeby. Thank you very much for the donation. Anybody else who wants to go do that for us, it's just www.patreon.com/turfpod. We're actually going to have something fun upcoming for the patrons very soon, so check it out.
It'll be an exclusive, we promise. That said, this was episode number 79 of the Artificial Turf Wars, and we'll be back at you in a couple weeks, barring any major Blue Jays news. Take care.